Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is producer Richard Younglord Frierson. First of all, I bet you didn't know, but not all recommendations coming from streaming networks are equal. And you would think that the big deal about streaming networks is the fact that they have this great recommendation engine. Well, turns out it's only great for some music genres and not for others. High-energy music like hip-hop and hard rock turn out to be less accurate than maybe some other ones that aren't quite as aggressive. As a result, fans of those genres tend to receive poorer recommendations than others. Now, there is a study by a number of researchers from Graz University of Technology, University of Innsbruck, and University of Utrecht. Did a big, long study, and they found that based on the artists that music users listen to most frequently, the authors of the research study used a computational model to predict how likely these music users were going to like the music recommended to them by not one, not two, but four music recommendation algorithms. And what they found was that listeners of mainstream music seemed like they received more accurate music recommendations than listeners of non-mainstream music. Those users who listened to mostly high-energy music appeared to receive the least accurate music recommendations, and those who mostly listened to music like ambient appeared to receive the most accurate recommendations. So, if you're listening to pop music, chances are that these recommendation engines are going to come up with something that you're probably going to like. But if you're listening to hard rock or metal or even really aggressive hip-hop, that's a whole lot less likely to happen. This is a big disappointment because, once again, the big deal with streaming networks is the fact that the recommendation engines have always been touted as being so accurate and such a big thing, and one of the reasons why you should be streaming. So it looks like that's not the case, at least for right now, and maybe this will change in the future. Hope so. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my Music Mixing Primer and 101 Mixing Tricks programs that will help take your mixes to the next level. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now, if I were to ask you, who has the quietest room in the world? You'd obviously think I'm talking about an anechoic chamber, and yes, I am. But where do you think it's located? Guess what? It's at the Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington. Yep, they have the Guinness Book of World Records for the quietest room in the world, and it's measured at minus 20.6 dB, which means it's 20 dB below the threshold of human hearing. And just to give you some reference here, a human whisper is at about 30 dB, your breathing is at 10 dB, and this is minus 20 dB. Now, the anechoic chamber took 2 years to design and build. It has 6 layers of concrete and steel. It's built on top of dampening springs, and there are 4-foot fiberglass wedges inside that stop all the reflections. The floor to get in is suspended on cables, and this is pretty much the same for most anechoic chambers. But there's a special 12-inch concrete wall encasing the whole thing. So word is that you can fly a 747 right outside and nobody's going to hear it. What does Microsoft use this for? They test audio gear, but mostly it's for clicks and hums from keyboards and mice and fans and displays and Xbox consoles and things like that. The previous world record holder is in Minneapolis. That's Orfeel Labs. And they're only rated at minus 9 dB. This chamber was actually built on the location of the old Sound 80 studios, and going way, way back to the 80s, Sound 80 was one of the best studios in the country. They had Bob Dylan and Prince, among other major stars that were working there. In fact, Orfeel Studios is more open not only to the public, because it actually does give tours there, but it's also open to outside industry to come in and test their gear. So they're testing things like automotive parts and the sound of hard drives, appliances, heart valves, sleep apnea machines, you name it. If you've never been in an anechoic chamber, I have to tell you, it's an eerie experience. And it's eerie because you can hear your heart beating so loud you can't believe it. You can even hear the blood coursing through your veins and the grinding of your joints as you move. So as a result, some people can't stay in for more than a few seconds because it just freaks them out too much. So what do you think the longest stay has been in an anechoic chamber? 55 minutes. That's it. Anyway, the next time you're in a trivia contest and the quietest room in the world comes up, you're going to know it's at the Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington. My guest this week is Richard Young Lord Frierson, who's a Grammy-nominated hip-hop and R&B producer and a founder of Truth Licensing, a major provider of music for films, TV shows, and commercials. Rich started producing for Puff Daddy's Hitman production team at the tender age of 16. His production credits include Puff Daddy, Notorious B.I.G., Fat Joe, Faith Evans, LL Cool J, New Edition, and many more. In 2014, he founded Truth Music Licensing, which now has a catalog of over 5,000 songs and has placed music on the Star and Empire television shows, commercials for Gatorade, Pepsi, and AT&T, among others. During the interview, we spoke about the value of asking people how they do things, how much the business aspect has changed since he started, his favorite techniques for vocal production, transitioning into music licensing, and much more. I spoke with Rich via Zoom from his home in New York. Take me back to the beginning. How did you get started?
You know, my music journey, I'd say my music career has been guided by women. I tell you, I know it sounds funny, but when I was 14, I had my first week of high school. And I remember meeting this girl that I went to school with. She was so beautiful, man. And I was walking her to the bus stop. And after she left, this guy came up to me and he said, "Hey, is that your girlfriend?" And so I was lying. I was like, "Yeah," you know, wishful thinking, you know. And he said, "Hey, are you into music?" And I said, "Well, I DJ a little bit, you know, not really." And he said, "Well, look, you know, I own a recording studio around the corner." He gave me his card. And he said, "You're welcome to come by whenever you want." And the guy was a legitimate player in the music business, you know, the hip hop, early 90s hip hop scene. And he let me sit in sessions. I would just go there, just like be a fly on the wall. And I got to see some, you know, some good sessions. And naturally, you know, the bug caught me. And you know, I found this one producer that worked for him. His name is Jesse West. You know, he was the one of the only one guy who would answer my questions. And from there, it was just, you know, you get captivated and that becomes in your life, you know?
Wow. So how old were you when this happened?
Yeah, I was 14 when that happened. And then started creating. And one thing I noticed, like, they were working on Mary J. Blige, What's the 411 remix album at the time, as well as like Heavy D Blue Funk album. So it was a lot of like Mount Vernon Uptown Records people. They kept mentioning this Sean Puffy guy, you know, and, you know, I always thought he was like an R&B guy. And then he came out with Flavor in Your Ear through his label. And I was at school one day and these girls were talking about it and a light bulb went off in my head. I said, "I need to get with that guy." And I called information, got the number to his office. And then I was able to set up a meeting.
Wow. He took a meeting with you.
I booked a meeting with his A&R guy. And through him, he, you know, brought my stuff up to him and set it up.
So did you just go and say, "I'm looking for a gig," or did you go with your music?
Well, I went with my music, but my leading thing was, look, I'm 16. I'm the best producer in the world. You know, you need to meet with me. And what's funny is I talked all that trash and they didn't like my music at all. they didn't like it. But it was funny. I listened to some of that stuff, and I mean, gosh, but he was so confident in himself that he felt that if I just hang out with him, that I'll get it at some point.
And is that what happened?
And that's exactly what happened. And I'm so appreciative for that confidence. It's so funny. I tell like a bunch of people that I mentor and talk to, they always say they're not ready yet, or say they have to finish this or get better. And I think if I would have waited, one more second, that window would have closed. I wouldn't have been able to get to them, because when I called, they just opened. So I was probably they probably happy to get calls anyway. But it's that they exploded, and that wouldn't be able to happen anytime after, I'm sure.
How long did it take you before you were working on your own projects?
Maybe say 96, so like another 2 years. Oh, yeah, make me like another year and a half, another year and a half, another year and a half.
So is that when you felt that, okay, I got this, I know how to do it? Or did that happen like sooner?
You know what? It didn't even happen like that. So I remember at the time Sean was working on New Edition, their Home Again album, and he had the whole group in the room playing the music. Then he got a phone call, right? So he left. So immediately I just went, put my tape in, and start playing music. And Michael Bivins, who's like just one of the best executives, he says, "Hey, you made that?" And I said, yeah. He said, okay. And then when Sean came back in the room, Mike Bivins took him to the side and he said, "I got this kid group that I'm working on. I want him to work on the kid group." And Sean was like, "Sure." The thing is, I didn't know what I was doing, and neither did they, So we made it work somehow. But so I don't think I was ready, when I got the shot to do it by myself. But I think that when you're thrown in it, you start, thinking of things and start trying to mimic things you've seen, and you start calling people and you start picking up things real quick, So you got, I was thrown into the fire.
Did you get into it technically?
What, creating?
Yeah. I mean, at what point was it like, I have to learn this gear more?
I think it was probably around the same time when I got with Bad Boy. I got into it technically and also theory wise, because the other producers that were there were like wired differently. They were geniuses. I was just like working on a sampler, had some drums, a little loop, but these guys, Chucky Thompson, Stevie J, Mary Winans, Derek Angeletti, these guys can play multiple instruments. They can hear something, play it, and make it sound like the record. These guys were advanced. So I knew to stay in the conversation that I would have to be able to learn that and and compete,
That's pretty deep. Did you learn most of it yourself, or did someone like mentor you with that?
A mix of both. I had a luckily I had supportive parents, and I guess somebody who worked with my dad, their friend was like a piano teacher, so he kind of taught me that stuff. So I had lessons from him, and then also the other people, especially engineers that we worked with, they were generous, overflowing generous with information as far as what did what and how it did it. And then it was just like with the actual like drum machines and samplers, just tinkering with it until you get it. I wish we would have had YouTube at that point, man. I would it would
Yeah,
have
yeah, yeah.
been crazy.
Yeah, I know. At that point, you basically had to go to school or you had to have a mentor
Yes.
because it was difficult to do it by yourself, that's for sure. It still is to a certain degree. There's so much information out there that it does get confusing.
Right, like which direction, which rabbit hole do you go down?
Yeah, Yeah, right. Did you settle on certain gear after a while? Was it like, oh, okay, I can make this work better than anything else, or I like the sound of this better than anything else?
I did, but I think and thankfully this was a big thing when I first got with Bad Boy. Sean said to me, he's like, look, you're younger than everybody. He said, people will talk to you, so ask questions and learn. And I would do that, but I made it a habit to do it. And I would, like, every 2 years, I would meet with everybody and ask them, like, I don't know, just how do you do what you do? How do you do it? Blah, blah, blah. Inside the creative part and in the business part as well. So what that did was it kept me aware of, like, the new gear that was coming out, you know, the you know what people were using and stuff like that. And then I also it's funny, once I graduated high school, maybe about 2 years later, I started getting interns from my high school, and that helped me more. I would take interns from anywhere because they actually taught me more than probably I was teaching them. But they would always have new things they were using, and it would completely change the way I was doing production. Like, I give you an example. I used to use MPC as my sequencer, and MPC 63,000, MPC 3000. I would have, you know, the MIDI keyboards, all that stuff. So I know it was one thing to, like, get different keyboards or different sounds, but Ryan Leslie was one of my guys that I brought in, and he created just on Pro Tools, just within Pro Tools, like, and he would record like it was a tape machine, you know, record the things and everything, and we'd transpose the keys if needed, or a replay, you know. But from being around him, you know, even though I was helping him with his career, he totally gave my career like another 10 years, because that way of doing production is what became, like, the new thing. It made it easier, quicker. You know, I was just able to create everywhere, and didn't have to lug around, you know, a bunch of gear everywhere. And,
Yeah.
you know, so it, yeah, that was my secret as far as keeping up, because yeah, the technology is like so much different from when I first, you know, began, you know.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So, how much has production changed in your mind? Yes, I know the gear, but is anything else that has really changed for you?
Oh, well, I'm the business, how the business works. I remember I used to, you know, make a track, play a track. Somebody would like it. Then you would, like, get an advance or something. Then you go in the studio, record it, then mix it, and then you get your second half, and then, you know, the album comes out or not. But now, like, everything has to be done first. You have to deliver pretty much the entire song in its mixed version at all times. You have to, it's no more like, creating in the studio. It has to be done pretty much with the track. Even with artists nowadays, you gotta have the right hooks on them. You know, you have to be able to, it's no more selling them the vision, it's showing them the vision. You know, they have to hear it. And that's a big difference. And then you don't get paid until, like, the album's coming out, like in, like, 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's really different on that end. But I'd say this, you know, right now, you make a hit, you have the opportunity to make more money than, you know, before, you know, than ever before, because it's more on a global thing. You know, if it connects, you know, you can get billions and billions of streams. Whereas before, you know, record would go platinum, but, like, people, like, you get a really good placement on Drake or something, and your life is changing, you know, just that one track right there.
Yeah.
And then, as far as the way that you create, it's people using templates. You know, they make it so quick now. You know, like, they make it so quick, and it's a lot of cookie cutter stuff. I would say it's still creative. I mean, you still have to because you create, you know, production, you're trying to capture a feeling, you're trying to capture that emotion, and that is something, that's a science, you know, that's a magical, you know, thing, you know. So if you're able to do that, whether using templates or whatever you got going on, it's still, that's still special, you know. But I think that, you know, a lot of these techniques, I think they're pretty cool, you know, but I also think that it, you know, because of that, there's so much more competition, and it's harder to build relationships with artists.
Do you have a favorite production trick that you tend to use all the time?
That's a good question. You know what I do? I guess it's, there is a thing, I forgot what you call it. It's parallel compression. That's something that I live by. I love the way it manipulates the sound of the drums. It keeps everything tight, and you still can have, you know, a vibe going on. So I love that. And then also, one thing I see that I'm consistently using is just our bass, you know, from Waves. You know, I just it just makes sense on everything.
Do you have a technique for getting like the best performance from a vocalist or a rapper?
Yes, my technique, because I was the worst vocal producer in the world, and so I met Ryan Leslie, who was I think he doesn't even do this anymore, but he, I think, is one of the best, because he I don't know how, like, I can't sing, but he was able to record a song with me singing and it sound good. So I was like, okay, it's anything's possible here. But my trick is, before we start anything recording, you know, I'm telling funny stories for at least 30 minutes. You know, we are laughing and becoming friends. I'm building trust with them. You know, I'm talking about their favorite songs and talking about things I loved about those favorite songs. Really connecting with them on just as a friend level, but so that I can build trust. And then I'm when they record, I'm just excited. I'm their biggest fan, even if it's, you know, starting out as bull crap. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting it. And then we'll you know, we'll get to some good parts, focus on that, and then I'll go back and circle and redo all the bad parts from the beginning again. And yeah, but I think that, and also kind of giving them a another one of my tricks is giving them a visual, a movie, a video of what it is they're doing, so they can be in the scene of where they are and know what type of emotion that I'm trying to elicit from them. You know, so if I can express that to them after some jokes, they usually come through what I need them to come through with.
Yeah, that's good. It's good. It seemed like you transitioned from production to music licensing at some point.
Yes.
That is a big transition in a way because it's creative to more business.
Yeah. Well, that it was I'll tell you how that happened. So, you know, growing up in the whole bad boy thing, it was tremendous success. Also, I try and mimic everything I see, right? And one of the things that I think made Bad Boy successful, you know, was that Puff would take us on trips where we would have fun. You know, we would, you know, wake up in the morning, play basketball, hang out, eat. And then we will work hard, you know. And I think that energy, that camaraderie is what made the hits. You know, I think that's really what did it. So I created my own situation that way. I brought a two-family house and converted it to a group home where any creative can come in, as long as you sign up my publishing company. You can live there. And I had somebody cook, clean. We would have fun and just create all day. And what that did was, it created a bunch of placements, but there was one hitch, was I was still signed to Janis Coen's publishing, Bad Boys publishing company. So I pitched Sean on I pitched him on letting me out of my contract and giving him a piece of this new company that I'm doing. And he's such a masterful negotiator that he's like, "Well, I believe in you. I believe in what you're doing, but I'm not going to let you out of my contract. But I'll give you some more money to come work for me and then do it with me, you know." And so I started working within that company, and one of the projects we worked on at that time was making of the band, making the band. So I was a part of creating all of the music for that, and also handling all of the the licensing and stuff with that. Me and a friend of mine named Kevin Johnson, I mean Kevin Thompson. And from there, we just kept doing it. And after my time was up there, me and Kevin decided to go and start our own thing, because we were in the groove, we were making it work. And from there, we built the pipeline, and then we just started getting other creatives, to come join us with the fun,
You have a lot of titles, right? You have like thousands of titles.
Oh man, I don't know. I don't know. I just know that I've been living a fantasy life, and I appreciate it.
It's easy to create. It's difficult to sell and get placements, especially if you're not of that world. So how did you learn about that?
About selling, honestly, I think that just trial and error. And then just being a networker, just super networker, and making friends with everybody, and somehow, luckily, my friends turning out into different things. Just meeting more people. You know 10 people, you need to know 1,000. You need to just meet people.
Very cool. Tell me about your latest project, the learning platform.
Right. So right now we're putting together Like a Genius. So remember I told you that I would go to everybody in every position to ask what they're doing and the best practices of it. So I'm doing it again, but this time I'm turning it into a course, and I'm filming it. So it's going to be an online school that teaches you how to monetize and market in each different discipline. So for like producers, we're going, to it's going we're going to teach you like what how to get in touch with the A&Rs, what they want to see from their mouths. We're going to teach you, you're looking for a manager, from the top manager, what would he need in order to manage you. We're going to so we're going to all of the different subject matter experts to get current action steps. And it's exciting, man. I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be tremendous value for students out there, or just people who are ready to make money out of what they're doing. Because it's like you said, it's one thing to create, but it's another thing to sell. And one of my, I guess, superpowers is I've always been able to find a way to sell, to sell. I mean, I'll create in my sleep, but to create systems to sell. So I want to kind of just give out some of that knowledge, because I do crazy things, man, to place music, and even with success and all that stuff, I still go, super duper hard, like I'll give you a funny story. When Jay-Z was doing the Black Album, I wanted to get a placement. I wanted to place on that album. So Hip Hop, who's the A&R, I know him well. He said, "All right, well, just send me some tracks." It was getting towards that time, where people were sending tracks. I don't want to sell any tracks. I'm going to play some music for him in his face. so I can, hype it up and, give my best shot forward. So he wouldn't make that happen, but that's not gonna stop me. So I don't know how I got this idea, but Young Guru, his engineer, popped in my mind. So I called him and I didn't even know him, but I knew he knew who I was, right? So I said, "Look, man, I love your mixes," right? Now he wasn't even a mixing engineer at the time, right? And I said, "I really have, I'm having trouble with, with my sound." I was like, "Can I sit with you for a few minutes to get some ideas on what I can do to increase my music, my mixes?" He said, "Man, sure, I'll be great to help you." He said, "The thing is, I'm working on J now, so you can meet me at the studio, but it has to be before 2 or after 10, right?" He gave me the whole schedule, right? So I showed up at 1:45, right? At 2 o'clock on the dot, Jay walks in and plays some music. Now, I met him previously, but we weren't like friends, So I say to him, I said, he says, "What's up?" Walks to the studio. I said, "Hey man," I said, "I gotta tell you," I said, "I have a 4-year-old daughter and she loves music. She just realized what I do, And she asked me, she said, "Daddy, did you ever produce Jay-Z?" And I said, "Man, I had to look at her in her eyes and tell her no, right?" I said, "You gotta help me change that so I could be a man in front of my daughter, right?" Yo, he started laughing, the same way you are, right? And he said, "Oh man," he said, "I wish you would have came last week." He said, "We're actually like recording the last two songs today and tomorrow," whatever, right? And but then he said, "Well, what you got?" And play him some tracks. And I didn't end up getting anything on the Black album, but he had me working on what's the guy's name? The Memphis Bleek and another act that he had that was coming out later. So it did turn into something, not what I wanted, but creating that atmosphere, I planned that out. That wasn't like by accident. I knew I needed something to break the ice. I knew I needed to take it away from music and to bring it back to it. And some people think that might be crazy, but that is a sales technique. And I'll tell you something funny, man. My daughter, she is she's like a little baby now. I didn't even have a kid back then. You know what I'm saying? So, but I knew I needed something to get that conversation going. So stuff like that is out of the ordinary and not direct, but that is kind of the information through stories that we're going to help people understand, because there's so much opportunity to connect with people, even though it's not anymore. It's like, but you just have to be creative in how you do it, but it's a way to do it.
That's one of the best ways I've ever heard. I have to say, you're smooth. Like a Genius, that isn't launched yet, is it?
No, it hasn't launched. We're going to be launching in June. Right now, we're editing and actually still filming a bunch of our geniuses, for the courses. But we have some heavyweights, man. This is really good, and it's not what you it's not instruction like do this, do that, da 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 da. It's like, here's a story of something that went horribly wrong, and here's a story that went horribly right. Take these action steps and do it, just try, So it's gonna be fun. I'm really excited about it.
I like your approach. It's way different than anything I've heard about.
It's because stories work for me, and I'm just I'll say this, I'm not anything like that I created. And what I mean by that is, most of the ideas that I have come from other people. They haven't come from me. I'm not that person, but I listen. And one person I got to become really close with was a guy named Clarence Avant, and he's a funny person, and he doesn't. There's no there's no reason something can't happen to him, you know. So I kind of adopted that. And he, one thing he would always say to me is, you know, he's just try it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. There's no way you can lose. And I lived with that. And that's why I would try crazy things like hitting up, you know, Jay-Z's engineer to get, you know, creating a whole thing. Because at the end of the day, now it's when I see Jay-Z, not every time, but most of the time, he asked me how my daughter's doing. You know, but it created a different conversation than he did with other producers. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's nothing. You know, you can't lose.
You're lucky he didn't ask to see a picture of your daughter when you did that.
I would have came up with one. My niece or something.
All right, Rich. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe someone imparted to you, or maybe you learned along the way?
The most important thing, and I didn't. Nobody told me this, but I saw this from working at Bad Boy. You're only as strong as your team. You know, you have to have a team, a great team with heart and belief in what your goal is. That's the only way you do it. The only way you can do it. And a lot of like artists I talk to, they try and do everything themselves. You know, they're social media people. They are editing their videos and trying to record their own songs and getting one song done every month. And, you know, I tell people, you know, find whatever part you can be great in and just focus on that and get a team around you to do everything else that's necessary. You know, because if you don't do songs, I don't care how good your social media is, it's not gonna move the needle, you know? So yeah. you having a team and creating a team, I think that's the most important thing.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.